Okay. Can everyone hear me okay? Is this good volume? Okay. So it's really always a privilege to come here in the evening and sit with what one of my Zen masters used to call way-seeking mind. And by way-seeking, he was referring to this path we follow to awakening to freedom from all forms of suffering. And I know some people don't come here for way-seeking mind. They just want to have a little less stress. So wherever you are, that's fine. It's interesting that the introduction is CIMC is a place of refuge. And it's really quite amazing, actually, when you think about this place is really dedicated to this this purpose of finding an unconditional inner peace. What motivated me to talk about refuge tonight, and I kind of focused on the negative part within within emotional and physical pain, in part because it was motivated by a group that I helped facilitate with Olivia Hoblitzbell. It's the Elders Group, which meets once a month. It's for people 65 and older. We've been doing it for about 3 years now. And Olivia led the group in December, and she suggested that people explore what their place of refuge was. And, refuge is a place of a safe harbor, a place where we feel protected, a place for the mind, heart to relax, to rest, to be at ease. So she asked them to explore where their refuge was, what their refuge was, and what they were taking refuge from. And so I led the group in January. It was just last week, actually. And I was really touched by the subject, in part because I was sick. I kind of dragged myself in that day to facilitate the group, and one of my sons was having an operation, and another son was dealing some difficult stuff. And it's like that, isn't it? There's always something going on to work with, and sometimes it's just little stuff, and sometimes it's really, really overwhelming type sort of thing. And fundamentally, this practice is about taking refuge to find a place of inner peace, a place of peaceful abiding right here, right now. And, quite often when you go on retreats, sometimes here, I know Narayan is going to actually, I think maybe the second Wednesday in February, she's going to lead a Wednesday evening taking refuge and taking refuge and also in the precepts. And so quite often we chant that we'll take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I can't imagine how many times I've chanted that, and you chant it three times every time you do it. And yet, I really, honestly, haven't tended to think of it as this practice is taking refuge, but of course that's what it is. So what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha? It doesn't mean to take refuge in the historical person who, as far as we know, was awakened, Gautama. It's to take refuge in the possibility of awakening, to take refuge in the possibility. It's actually possible to be free of all forms of dukkha. That's what the Buddha taught. I teach one thing only, dukkha and the end of dukkha. And dukkha is usually translated as suffering, but it's a very subtle word. And the level of subtlety is at a level where you wouldn't think of it as suffering. It's this kind of existential angst, the sense of someone outside of experience. And it's the end of that sense of someone outside of experience, the end of separation, that's the end of dukkha. And it's available to us right now in this very moment. And so I think, you know, when, I don't know, it was Doug Phillips is going to have a workshop this weekend on right view, and I would bet that Doug will talk about this, that that's really a fundamental aspect of right view, is this non-separation. It's a fabrication, a sense of construction that the mind creates. So, in some sense, there has to be some conviction or faith, or various translations of the Pali word sadha, that this is going to work. It's what gets us here. There's something, well, you know, I'll give this a try. Or, I mean, for me, I read a line in a book called A Way of Zen by a Zen master, and he said, thinking will get you nowhere. And it just so resonated with me. I just thought, that's it. And, you know, I don't know, many years later, I was practicing in the Zen tradition doing koans, where you're given some sort of question to ask, to manifest, really, not to provide an intellectual answer to. And, you know, I was going in and seeing this rather Marine Corps kind of Zen master 4 times a day, sprinting into his cabinet and then doing 3 frustrations at an elevation of over 6,000 feet and breathing hard. And I was supposed to manifest this koan. And, you know, 3 days, 12 times, ringing the bell, sending me off. And then like the 12th time, he said, you'll never be free as long as you go down the mind road. It was like this thing that got me into my practice in the first place, just coming right back at me, trying to come up with some intellectual answer to something that's well beyond the intellect. In fact, the intellect often causes the problem. So, it, you know, a lot of people come with much more modest ambitions, and that's fine. Maybe you just want to relax a little bit, or be more responsive in your daily life. And, you know, that this faith or conviction that that might work can come from a lot of different sources. There's all kinds of empirical evidence now. You know, there's mindfulness-based stress reduction, which insurance companies are paying for, so they're convinced. There's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. All this stuff has kind of, you know, moved out from the teaching of this 2,500 years ago. It's really amazing when you see the vast wisdom that's there, whether it was ever a Buddha or not. There's just this amazing teaching that's available to us to help us find our way to freedom. So there's refuge in the Buddha, this sense of some conviction, some not blind faith, but some faith based on something, maybe somebody you know or something you read or some experience you've had, that's possible. It helps us keep going. And then there's taking refuge in the Sangha. Sangha means community. You know, and in one sense, community is all of us sitting here together. And I really encourage you, like, you know, this evening, if you can, to stay afterwards and have tea and talk with people. It's really a great opportunity to explore the practice, to support each other, to connect. And it's really helpful to have someone to talk when things are really difficult. Not in a complaining sort of a way, but a way to explore, you know, where's the wisdom here? And, you know, my experience is that it was hard to get to know people here. You know, I led practices and all kinds of things. It just took a long, long time. But now, every New Year's Day, I have a group of people over to my place. We've got 35 or 40 people. Almost all of them are practitioners. And you know, they uniformly say, this is the most wonderful event of my year. And it isn't because I'm such a great host, because, you know, I hardly have time to even talk to anybody. But it's because the people are so wonderful. Someone said to me, you know, people aren't there puffing themselves up. They really care about you. So this is another thing, to take refuge in the Sangha. So refuge in the Buddha, the Sangha, and finally refuge in the Dharma. And refuge in Dharma is a refuge in the teachings of the Buddha. And he's not asking you to take a blind belief in things. Someone came, I talked to Beginner's Drop-In last night, someone came up and said, well, I'm Jewish and I really don't get into this Buddhism stuff. And I said, this isn't about some belief system. He's laying out a conceptual framework. And then he's saying, Ehipasiko, come see for yourself. Experientially, is this true for you? So there's this teaching, which I think Doug is going to talk about some, and I imagine also talking about, then there's a practice, and there's an embodiment of it. It becomes part of you. So what I want to do this evening is talk fairly extensively about the Dharma piece, and you know, it's a rather broad topic, because that's what the whole teachings are about. And the Buddha, you set this framework out in his second teaching of these four noble truths, which no scholar likes this translation, but that's the one that's used. They prefer four ennobling truths, I think. That there is dukkha. This is the truth of things. This is universal. It isn't just you. And it isn't your dukkha. It's there. It isn't owned by anyone. So by dukkha, suffering, stress, I'm going to talk about the elders group some, so you get a good idea of dukkha if you don't already know what it already is. And even when you get things all lined up, it's all, you know, sometimes the Pali word in Nietzsche is translated as impermanence most of the time, but it's also, everything's contingent, dependent. You just never know. You know, Joseph Goldstein has this great phrase, anything can happen anytime. I came over here last night to teach Beginner's Drop-In. There was an accident. I had plenty of time. There was an accident, so I had to take some detour. Ended up coming down Mass Ave, which I hadn't planned on doing. And I didn't realize that you could make a left turn on Mass Ave on Prospect, and a cop did. So, so I was very polite, you know, and he just gave me a warning, you know. But I was just kind of sitting there coming to my body and, oh, well, you know. It's life's like that, right? So these four noble truths, the first is there is dukkha, and the second is there's a cause. And, you know, the cause fundamentally, we only have 45 minutes or so tonight, is we want things to be different than they are. And there's cessation, which, okay, if we don't want things to be different than they are, then there's no dukkha. This whole sense of someone outside the experience and all the stuff that shouldn't be happening is just because we resist it, in some sense. In this very moment, we resist it. And I'm not saying, like, this is easy. I'm not saying I'm totally free of this. I mean, it resonated with me, the topic. It resonated with me because there's still issues to work with. And then there's this path to freedom. And I'll talk about this a little bit in a moment, this eightfold path. So these four noble truths, there's dukkha, there's a cause, there's cessation, we can actually be free of all this, and there's a path to cessation. So, the elders group is just magnificent. I mean, these people have been practicing for a long time. And one doesn't have to teach there. One just kind of brings up the topic and just sits and listens. And so we started with one woman sharing that she's in a home for the elderly, and she's the average age for the home, which is 87. As she said, there's a lot of really old people there to average out to 87. And what happens is that every time someone dies, and she's shared this a few times now, they put a rose up and a little card. And she raised the question, how do we have intimacy without attachment? How can we be close to these people without all the loss and lamentation and grief that we experience when this person's gone? And I remember when I was in what's now called the Experience Yogi class, for a long time we worked with this Teach Me How to Care and How Not to Care. And I can't remember if that's T.S. Eliot or E.E. Cummings. I don't know if anybody knows. But it's like a koan to hold, right? And then someone else shared who I just amazing what's happened to her practice in just the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, just so much dukkha for so long, and then somehow. I mean, this particular person lost their partner a few years ago. Perhaps that was kind of the, because that happens sometimes. Tremendous loss kind of takes us deep into something. And she was reflecting that she does this practice of the five remembrances. And there's various translations of it. The first three are, you know, what's often called the heavenly messengers, the thing that got the Buddha interested in all this old age, sickness, and death. You know, just to reflect that I'm subject to old age, I'm subject to sickness, and I'm subject to death. That's true for every one of us, right? And then the fourth reflection is that I will lose everything near and dear to me. And then the fifth one is that you are the heir to your actions. And I talk some about karma, about how we really form ourselves by our actions over time. And she said, when I did the fourth reflection, that I will lose everything near and dear to me, I used to think about material things. But then she really realized that everything, everyone she ever knows, she will lose. Either she will leave them or they will leave you. And she said, I just had a sense that this was, there's okayness about it. It was all okay. And she said, you know, there's no problem at all. It's just all our views and opinions about how we think things should be. All our fabrications, our mental constructions. And what I love about this, I mean, I actually asked her if she'd come talk tonight, but probably I'd have to get permission for her to come talk, and she didn't want to come talk anyway. She said, I don't remember what I said anyway. But I remember, and it was coming from the heart. These are people really going through it. And then a couple other people shared about health problems and how it's fundamentally okay. One person who's had several operations and is going to get another operation early in February. And he shared that he was talking to a friend about this operation he's going to get, and the friend said, oh, I know someone had that operation, and they died. And he said, and I said, well, thank you for sharing that. But he really did. He had this sense of okayness about this. I mean, I wish you could be there, because you wanted some conviction in this practice. Boy, that was a place to get it. Okay. So back to this path, this fourth ennobling truth. Part of it is this wisdom, this wise view about seeing things, which Doug Phillips is going to talk about this weekend, and he's a really great teacher. I'm sure he'll do a wonderful job. Is it Doug Phillips or is it Lee Brasington? Be careful. Oh, Lee Brasington. He's good too. So part of his wise view, which is a conceptual way of seeing things, and part of wise view is intention, which is this kind of willfulness or some doing, and this intention of kindness, compassion, simplicity. Okay? And then there's ethics, a sense of integrity about things. And a lot of early practice, maybe for a long time for some people, is creating a sense of uplift, of goodness. You're actually trying to create what we call a healthy self. And so that practice, you know, if we bring a quality of kindness to others and compassion and to ourselves, it's uplifting. I mean, maybe don't do it just because it's like it's ethical. Do it because it's good for you. Just simple things like when you open the door for someone, if you really take that in, what that's like. There's this guy, Rick Hansen's a neuroscientist. He has this acronym called HEAL. So have a good experience, enhance it, which is basically take it in all the ways possible, bodily, emotionally, mentally. Just be aware how it feels. So have a good experience, enhance it, absorb it, take it in. And the last part I'm not going to talk about, which is link, which basically is after you really feel good, you bring up something. You bring up something that's difficult for you. And what happens over time is that starts writing over the unhappy memory. So a lot of practice is really finding a way to uplift yourself. And believe it or not, meditation, that's the intention of meditation, too. It probably doesn't feel that way a lot of times. So I want to talk a little bit about meditation. Most of the time, we're taught to come to the breath. However, I really prefer taking an approach of holistic awareness to our practice. This word meditation often gets translated as concentration, but rather think of it as unification and developing calm. Unification of what? Unification of body, heart, and mind. So by mind, in Buddhism, there's a word citta, which is translated as mind, heart. They don't separate the two. But by mind, I'm speaking here of this conceptual part of our mind, the ability to think, plan, organize. It's very useful when it's used in a way to free oneself. But often it's driven by aversion, loneliness, grief, fear, and it can do all kinds of unwise things. Okay, so the problem is, in this society, we live up here in this conceptual framework. We're fragmented. We're not whole. We're not unified with our body and our heart. Ajahn Sucitto, a teacher I love so much, said that we're like a head on wheels. Yeah. I mean, I drive over here and I go through Harvard, and people are walking around, you know, their cell phones, you know, we were reading, you know, it's just like they're just all in their head. Body, I mean, you know, we kind of have these exterior views of body, you know, it's like Ajahn Sucitto says, you know, beauty's about a millimeter thick, you know, but a lot of practice is really coming into the body. The body is our ground. It's the place that we can discharge emotions. It's a place of stillness. The mind doesn't have a ground. It's only ground is constant movement. And this heart piece is this, you know, it includes emotions, but it's also qualities like determination, perseverance. I know Madeline Klein has been teaching a course, or is going to teach a course on the Paramis, these qualities that we can have. But it's this felt sense of things. If, you know, this doesn't feel right. It's what gets us here, right? So it got me here. There's some sort of, this is not right, and I really somehow think there's something way out of this. So when we sit, we want to bring together all these three forms of intelligence, and to think of ourselves rather than something solid, me, that's all this happening to. How about if we think of ourselves as processes? The body is a process, this emotional heart piece is a process, the mind's a process. And the nice thing about that is it's dynamic, it can change. You know, it's not like I'm always like this or I'm always like that. What we think of as ourselves, really, are these patterns that we've learned to live in. I'm a happy person, I'm a sad person, I'm a, you know, bright person. But it's just these kind of patterns that manifest over time that we call self. And a lot of early practice is to create skillful patterns. Kindness, compassion, simplicity, developing calm. So I want to move to, there's a nice little acronym called RAIN. And if you just Google it, you can probably find some, or put RAIN in Buddhism or something like that. You'll probably have a nice little write-up on it by various people. It's just an acronym that was introduced as a practice for dealing with dukkha. The R stands for recognize. The A stands for, could be allow or accept. The I is to investigate. And the N is not to identify with. And so I want to talk a little bit about kind of finding a place of inner freedom within that framework. And often we think of we're going to get it outside. I mean, our society tells us that all kind of advertising, you know, we'll get good sense experiences, we'll have connections that are be uplifting. And that's true. We can find wonderful things outside of ourselves, but they're not lasting. Emotions come and go. Relationships come and go. And so the way to find some freedom is to go inward. So we first, like, we notice there's some form of suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. And then rather than trying to fix it, which is our kind of reactive way of dealing with things, who wants to deal with unpleasant stuff? But the problem is when we distract ourselves or find some way to fix it, the underlying core thing that's causing the problem is still there. It's actually embodied. And so in order to become free of it, we need to find a way to open to it. And so we can begin opening to it. I mean, sometimes we're just told, just allow, open to it, accept. But it can be overwhelming. So then we can use these qualities of what are sometimes called the Brahma-Viharas, or I like the term immeasurables, kindness, compassion, appreciation of other people's joy, a quality of equanimity, and bring those in so we can open to things. And we might do that by using some phrase like an equanimity phrase might be, can I make room for this? Because what happens is the mind contracts around things. Things seem overwhelming because our focus is so narrow. Joseph Goldstein has a nice little phrase I quote all the time. You know, he adds, you're thinking about something and you say, and the sky is blue. It just gives a little bit more, there's something else going on in your own little turmoil in this moment. You know, sitting in a car waiting for a policeman to write up a ticket for you or something. Or you might use a compassion phrase. May I care for my pain? May I care for my sorrow? So what we're trying to do when we use these, or how is my breathing in this? And what the intention here is to create enough sense of uplift that we can be with the experience. And when we have enough, you know, we're trying to, or you might even use a phrase like Budo, which means to awaken, just something we want to simplify the outside enough so that there's some capability of being here with what's going on. And then we want to bring really three qualities, one of which is talked about quite often in this practice, this quality of awareness, the simple capability of stepping back that we all have. I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it. We can actually step back and watch our thoughts. We can watch our emotions. We don't have to be lost in it. It's not what we are. So maybe do a little experiment. I don't know how this will work, but if it doesn't, play with it some. Just be aware of what's happening right now. You can hear the sounds of me talking. Perhaps to feel the pressure of your buttocks on the cushion or bench or chair. You might feel temperature. So there's the sense experience, and there's a knowing of it, right? Now, just shift a bit and be aware of yourself. And let awareness be aware of you. I mean, really do this. Don't just. So where is awareness? It's both inside and outside. It's everywhere. And it's there all the time. We don't realize that because it kind of fades in and out. But when you just start paying attention to it, there's this knowing that's occurring, even when you're lost. And then then the awareness become you sort of come back in, you know you were lost, right? There was something there that knew you were lost. And often it knows where you were lost. It's just there all the time. This is a refuge. Often awareness is kind of described as mirror-like. I prefer Ajahn Sucitto's kind of empathic awareness. It's a sensitive awareness that's just there, that's perfectly fine with everything just the way it is. This is kind of part of the okayness, I think, the elders group would refer to. Just this, right now, this very moment, it's possible. And it's not easy. We get hooked. But that's kind of the teaching is, there's this realization that this is the case. And there's sudden awakening and there's gradual cultivation, working off all our little hooks that we haven't gotten through yet. So that's one aspect, just this pure knowing that's there, this empathic knowing. And that's a huge refuge. Another aspect is what Ajahn Sucitto referred to as presence, a sense of here-ness. So you can feel bodily sensations, maybe a pain in the knee or a pain in the back. But there's also this interior, that's kind of exterior sensation, right? It's the mind being aware of something outside of itself. And there's this interior, which is this sense of just presence, of here-ness. It doesn't have a location. You can't find it anywhere. It's much like awareness. And some ways to kind of get in touch with that is, and it's also a helpful way when you do have unpleasant bodily sensations. And boy, I've been working with a lot the last couple of weeks. Nausea, headache. One is to be aware of the rhythm of the breath. So we're often aware of the breath, but really just aware of the breathing process. It has a rhythm to it. And being aware of that rhythm, it's kind of like, I used to take one of my youngest son, we had a babysitter who was very nervous and he was very sensitive. And boy, he would just cry with her. And I would just pick him up and I would just do some walking meditation. I would chanting this Namu Dai Bo Sa, and he would just calm down. So it was just, you know, it was this rhythmic calmness that the body, that the breath can be if you can just learn to be with it, just to notice it's got a rhythm to it. And then there's this sense of groundedness. Yeah, you can think of it as the buttocks on the cushion and the feet on the floor. There's just a sense of this here-ness here. And finally, there's this spaciousness. So we contract around bodily pain, emotions. So we start expanding the awareness of the entire body, maybe starting with your hands. I wish I had more time. I could go through a kind of guided thing of this. But just start with places that don't have a lot of charge, like the hands, the feet. And you just start expanding, taking a whole body, and then being aware of the space around it. So there's groundedness, spaciousness, rhythm of the breath. Play with those. Rather being caught up in the external bodily sensations that are unpleasant, it's not that they're not there, but there's just this something much bigger to hold it. So it's like putting a grain of salt in a small thing of water versus a big bucket. It doesn't have much effect when it's in the big bucket. And finally, there's this quality of tenderness that we really can settle in. There's something really tender that can just meet whatever's going on. So our practice is to recognize there's some sort of stress, to develop the good, and then what we might call clarity. It's just like there's just this suchness, this of this quality of awareness, of this presence that's just there that can hold everything. And sometimes people talk about, well, everything comes out of that awareness of stillness. But actually, it's not separate. There's in the Zen tradition, we often chant, form is emptiness, that which is form is emptiness, that which is emptiness is form. Form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. So this awareness might be what you think of as the formless. And our experience is the form. But they're not different. They're just different perspectives on things. And the more we can rest in this kind of formless peace, the more it's fine. To just know it's there. Okay. So the next part, investigation, is once we've really settled in, then we can start looking at, why am I suffering so much? Why am I so upset? What causes all these problems? And we don't have to answer them intellectually, although sometimes it's helpful to explore, what am I pushing away? What do I want? Isn't every time we're suffering something psychological or physically we don't want, right? It's the don't wanting that causes the suffering. So it's how can we find a way to open? This is the second noble truth. The cause of suffering is, you know, depending on how refined you want to be, attachment, holding on to things, wanting things to be a particular way. And so if you can free yourself, it just, life is life. I love the quote, this one Zen teacher, I've done this a lot of times, but it's just so great, you know. He's talking to the whole group, not just me, and he said, the universe doesn't care about your opinion. And the sooner we get that, the sooner we'll have some freedom. It just isn't going to line up the way we want it. And I've listened to several talks in the last few weeks, including, I also gave a talk, and every teacher said, we come here thinking we're going to get everything sort of lined up so everything will be okay. And every teacher says the same thing in the end. Uh-uh. It's being okay with conditions just the way they are. That's the inner freedom. That's the refuge. Not resisting. And that's a difficult thing to do. But at least having that direction can be helpful. This investigation is to look at the changing nature of things. I'm taking a course now. It's kind of interesting. It's this called Persistent Non-Symbolic Experience, which is some academic thing about awakening experiences. But, you know, what he's having you do is meditate, and then after you settle down, just at the end of the last half hour, so you have an hour, then he just says, just be really focused on the experience, you know, and very detailed, and just say, go on. And it's just a nice way to bring to your consciousness that everything is changing, and it's changing so fast, it's unbelievable. But the reason we don't know that is we get grabbed onto things. We push things away. We conceptualize them. And if we see everything's changing, all the emotional experiences we think are ours, all the physical experiences we think are ours, everything, you know, these patterns we think are ours, are just constant change. Where is the self? This is all this is happening to. This teaching of not self is really, it's not trying to take away your happiness. He's actually trying to, you know, for a long time, get you to have a healthy self through these uplifting qualities. But then he's saying, you know, you can't control things. So no matter how good a job you do, it's cultivating kindness, compassion, how simple your life is, how much you meditate, things happen. And so the freedom is just being able to, not just, learning to soften into, allow it to be, not resist. And so our investigation is, what are we resisting? What are we trying to get to? And the last part, not identify, I mean, part you could sort of make it clearer, when moi comes into the picture, notice how the suffering works. It's just, oh, it's all about, I mean, how many times are you suffering about you, right? How people are treating you, how your needs aren't getting met, you know, how you should be a better person. All these ideas that we've gotten taught. Okay. So I want to read a few things. One on this impermanence. This is from a book called Women of the Way. And this particular part of it is about a nun called Teijitsu. Her name is Teijitsu. And she had an awakening experience. She saw that all phenomena arose, abided, and passed away. She saw that knowing this arose, abided, and passed away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this. No ground, nothing to lean on, stronger than the cane she held. And she opened her clenched fist in her mind, and that's where it is, in this mind, and let go and fell in the midst of everything. So when we see, I mean, all is going on, moment to moment, are these sense experiences and knowing experiences, they come and they go and they come and they go and they come and they go very rapidly. Then this sense of separation falls away. And there's a sense of we're everything. Nisargadatta Maharaj has this wonderful thing. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. This is what's possible for us. There's also a story about a woman named Padakara that we talked about in the elders group. And actually, there's another discourse where she's awakened, and it just kind of happens like that. But in this one, she's suffering big time. She loses her husband, she loses two children, and in extremely tragic ways. I mean, those losses are always tragic, but they're extremely, and she's lost. She's running around for clothes, half falling off. And she comes to the Buddha, and this is a little write up from Musung, who's a teacher out at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies on what happened. So the Buddha says to Padakara, regain your presence of mind. Which is really talking about this awareness, this sense of presence. And when she hears that, she seems to come to terms with her own practice. I'm sorry, she seems to cut to the core in terms of her practice. Seeing grief as grief, sorrow as sorrow, joy as joy, and so on. But also seeing each includes a seeing that's free from sorrow, from joy. In other words, each moment of grief, sorrow, joy, etc. is grief, freedom from grief, sorrow, freedom from sorrow, joy, freedom from joy. So whatever is going on, all these difficult emotional experiences, there's always something, this quality of awareness and presence that just holds it, that's free from it. It's not that we don't have them, but there's just this quality here. And so we can ask ourselves questions in the midst of anger. You know, where's the love in this? In the midst of being discomfort, where's the comfort in this? There's something that holds all of this. So I'm going to kind of bring this to close with two more readings. This is the one that Olivia offered. It's a quote from, in the Practice for Elders group, it's a quote from Rumi. It's always check your inner state with the Lord of your heart. And to check your inner state with the Lord of your heart is really this quality of awareness that just knows what's going on. Copper doesn't know it's copper until it's turned to gold. Your loving doesn't know its majesty until it knows its helplessness. And this is where our practice takes us, really. It takes us to open to our vulnerability, to non-resistance. And in that, there's connection. There's non-separation. I gave a talk some time ago called Bow to Now. Because that's all there is. And I went through a period where just really tragic things were happening. My son was in a hospital, and for a while I was in this place of stillness and okay, and then I got sick because I'm sitting around a hospital all night long. And I had a friend who, her husband had cancer of the kidney. And we shared. I mean, this is the beauty of Sangha. Sort of shared what was going on, not in a complaining way, but just this is what's happening to me. And she wrote this on iPhone, and it was so beautiful. I thought, I have to give a talk on this. She said, "Thank you, my friend, for sharing the inevitable and sad dukkha that comes into all our lives. We all have these things happen to us. Different forms, characters, and situations, but nevertheless, pointing to the first noble truth. When a loved one becomes ill, there is no place to rest. Stillness is there at times, and we notice and bow to stillness. And stillness is this quality of awareness, just resting in it. And then sadness, and we bow to sadness. And compassion, and we bow to compassion, and we bow to that. The ebb and flow of non-attachment and attachment. The Bodhi mind, and the mind and the heart of a man, father, husband. I know that dance well. Sadness exists through frustration or overwhelm or the ouch of the situation. You, my friend, are dealing with a lot, including the human dislike of being powerlessness, of being powerless. And grappling with the unknown, my heart holds you and your wife with much understanding, with love, and with the faith that you will navigate this difficult time with stillness and sadness, enlightenment and human." So they're both there. It's the same thing as Rumi. Our helplessness, to open to that, to our vulnerability. And in that, there's something inherently okay. So let's just sit for a minute.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.